The following talk was given by Steve Hagen on June 14, 2024. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Howdy, everybody. Thanks for coming. Welcome. Maybe we'll get started. So my name is Rick Palm, and I've been a student of Steve Hagen's since 2007. So it's a real pleasure for me to be able to introduce him tonight. But first, the Blue Stone Zen group that is sponsoring this tonight sits Soto Zen meditation Wednesday evenings and Saturday mornings. And on Wednesday evenings, we also do a Zen meditation instruction. So if after the talk you're interested in signing up for getting emails from us, that's on the back there. And also on the back is a brochure and a sign-up sheet for emails from Dharma Field Zen and Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis, which is important for people from here that want to do continued learning because you can take classes online through Zoom and Sunday morning talks from Steve and other really adept teachers. Steve grew up in Duluth, and he graduated from Denfeld class of 1964, and I think there's at least one fellow graduate here. Then went on to Minneapolis, studies in biology, and began to study Buddhism in the late 60s. In 1975, he met Katagiri Roshi, who started the Minnesota Zen Center on what's now called Bademakaska in South Minneapolis, and in 79 was ordained as a Zen priest, and then went on to study inside and outside the country with different teachers, and then in 1989 was giving Dharma transmission, which is an endorsement to be able to teach. And then after Katagiri passed away, groups got together, coming to his house, uninvited. Yeah. And then in 1997 started Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis, which continues to be active today. And about the same time started to write books and publish. And there's over a half a dozen books, one of them a bestseller, Buddhism Plain and Simple. And maybe some of you have already read that, but continues to write and continues to teach. And we're glad to have him here tonight. Thanks, Steve.
Well, good evening. It's good to see you all. I'm happy to be here. It's been quite a while since I spoke here last. Well, tonight I thought I might, given the situation that we're all in here now in this country with this political year, and it's rather insane political year, really kind of different and maybe kind of crazy, and a lot of people I think are pretty worried about what's happening and what might happen and all of that. Very understandable, but I thought maybe I could give a little sense of, I don't want to say the Buddhist angle on it or anything of that sort, because I can't really give you that, but I can say a little bit about perhaps a different way of looking at the whole situation that we find ourselves in, that we might not be so used to thinking about or seeing. But we can begin with, for each of us, you know, here we come into this world not knowing very much. At least we might think that. I don't know if I totally agree with that. But certainly when it comes to our conceptual understanding of things and our way of intellectually grasping the world and our actions and our behaviors, understanding how to live. What does that even mean? But maybe how to live in a peaceful way, a harmonious way, maybe with a bit of understanding and wisdom and calmness and generosity and humility and maybe just an understanding how to live a happy life. The ancient Greeks, they spoke of, it's pronounced in different ways and with different shades of meaning, but they spoke of eudaimonia, how to live in a way where we might be happy. We've probably done a pretty poor job in really working this out. All the various religious teachings that we might encounter that we've invented and created and developed and, or believe that they're inspired in some way, all the different ways we might understand these things, the various philosophies that we've developed, the various sciences we've developed and have taken on just to try to understand this world and its dynamic living of this world, of which each one of us, this is our life that we're living out. The whole world is our life. We probably don't normally look at it that way, but we see it from my point of view. As I said, when we come into this world, seems like we don't know much, but right away we have people, bigger authorities than us, as tiny babies and children, who they'll tell us how to live and what we must do and what is right and what is wrong and what is good and what is bad, or even what is good and what is evil. And then if we don't really look carefully at what is pointed out for us, we can easily take on ideas and notions, beliefs, behaviors, understandings that really don't lead to a happy life or to a deep understanding of what is going on here. But this is at the heart of the teaching of the awakened, which I will call it, Buddha Dharma is the word. It's been, well, here in the West, we call it Buddhism. But I don't know what Buddhism is. I've studied this my entire adult life. Well, not so much Buddha, well, I used to call it that. I thought that's what I was studying. There's no such thing as Buddhism. As my teacher used to say, it's just one of the isms. And being one of the isms is just one of the separations and distinctions drawn in the world between what we are here immediately and in all of that, and all of those people, and the way they think, and the way they behave, and the way they want to carry on, what their politics are, well, the whole thing. Some of it might seem, comes from others, it might seem threatening to us, and they might strike us as being not very good. Maybe they're evil. We want to shape our world and our lives and everything around us here so we can live the good life and do the right thing. But very few of us agree on anything. There are different parties and factions and things that gather together in different ways that will fight in large groups against others, other large groups. And we can do it individually in our lives as well. And clumping together with those that seem to be like-minded. And oftentimes, if you're like-minded in a few things, you're probably like-minded in a lot of things. But there's still differences. And it's difficult. It's difficult to know what is right. And what is this world? What is this all about? Well, this is something that certainly I had questions about as a young person. Wanted to make sense of living here on this planet. But then seeing, I hit the Vietnam War right at the perfect age to be conscripted into the military. And Oh, I won't tell you my story there. But right from the very start, all sorts of things to ask questions about there. Do you just say yes, sir, and salute and go on and obey this or obey that? Or obey this philosophy or that religion or whatever it might be? It didn't work for me as a young person because I wanted to know for myself what is good and right and what I should practice and live out. Pretty early on, I was attracted to Buddhism and other Eastern forms of thought, and particularly Taoism as well as Zen Buddhism. So I spent a lot of time looking into these things, but many things, other religions and philosophies as well. Again, finding, well, we don't seem to understand this or that, but somebody will have a very good theory going here, very good set of hypotheses or whatever, and they're working with that. And then other people will chime in to weigh these things out, trying to understand things like, what is belief? And how does that differ from knowledge? It would seem to differ from knowledge, but how? And that's been with us since the ancient Greeks, and philosophers are still trying to sort that out. There's a real simple reason why they can't, and maybe some are beginning to realize that they can't. Probably some have all along. But for all of these things that we might ponder, get embroiled in, get into arguments with certain people, we get on the bandwagon and really try to promote this idea or that behavior, whatever it might be, it's all very confusing and very confused. How many of us really know what is going on here? And I would say very few. Because what we're going to, if you want to start to see what's happening here, you have to realize that whatever you grasp, whatever belief you take hold of, and belief is really the simplest definition, which I think gets more to the point than anything, is a belief is something that you think is true, is real, is best, that actually explains what's happening here, and upon which we can build other ideas, other philosophies, other structures, other sciences, whatever it might be. And yet, here we have this world in the 21st century among educated people and uneducated people who, for the vast majority of us, we don't know. And I would say it is because we don't understand knowledge. We don't understand that we do know. You know. You know truth. You know reality. You're living it out every moment of every day. How could you not know this? And if you want me to specify what this is, that's part of your confusion, because you want to find something there that you can grasp, and you want me maybe to identify this or that. But if I did that, that would just be more confusion. Saying, this is the truth here. No, identify something. And it's because somebody else can come along and say, no, that's not it. It's this over here. And there we are. This is where we remain. All the while, unless we wake up to something. And I mentioned them earlier, the awakened. They're not Buddhists. But what the awakened see is something radically different from what we normally see, what we normally think, what we easily believe. Of course, we believe all kinds of things, yes, but it's of a certain nature, a nature that whatever it is, it can be grasped and held by the mind, even if it's a mystery. Oh, we know this about it, there we have it, we can kind of identify where it is or what it might entail or whatever. But at its heart, it's really a mystery. But we don't even know why it's a mystery. We might think, because we want to get the idea of why it's a mystery. Just all of this. What we don't recognize is something that we actually do know, is that it only appears this way to us because we are trying to name it, trying to label it, trying to grasp it, trying to get hold of it. And we can't do it. And so it seems, in the end, yeah, this might be true, that might be true. You're sitting out there in front of me and I'm talking. Yeah, there seems to be some truth there. Yeah. But whatever we put out there, if we keep pursuing it, most of us don't pursue it too far, but if you do, you'll realize that you're not holding anything. You haven't gotten hold of the truth. And the reason is simply because you can't. I can't either. We can't get hold of truth. But we live it. It's what's being lived out. It isn't like it's not familiar to us. How could we be without it? So what's going on here? Well, it's very simply is we haven't learned to pay attention to reality, to truth. Why is that? Well, it's because we grasp this, we grasp that. We want to figure out, what are you saying there? As I'm talking, I don't mean anything. Meaning is, if I'm not talking about this, I'm talking about something else over here. This means that over there. Meaning takes us like that. And so I don't mean anything by what I'm saying here. Because that would just be an idea. If you got hold of something that you think I mean, well, now you've just gotten hold of an idea, a grasped object some way, grasped with your mind. It's a concept, a belief, whatever. Well, there are people, they're called the awakened. I would call them the awakened. Don't ask me to name one. I can't. You'll never get hold of, I've never gotten hold of any such people as this. But they're called the awakened. There are people who see through this. They see what the problem is. And they can live out of that and live free of confusion. But they're not holding anything. To the extent that in this moment they're awake, they're not holding anything. And they don't have to because here we are. It is just this. It's always just that we can't be apart from this. It's when we have a Zen saying, well, there's a lot of them are like this, where the teacher will say, with the least flexing of your mind, immediately you're confused. Because what you've done is that you've taken hold of one thing or another in a conceptual form, and you're carrying on as if this were the case. But it is not the case, because what is the case cannot be grasped. But it can be seen. But this is what the awakened understand. And to give maybe some sense of just how profound this is, I thought maybe I might use this, I don't know. This is how deep it goes. We might think, that there's, different objects here or whatever, or thoughts or feelings. We can describe them. But as we go in deeper, we start to realize that well, whatever it is that we're describing or touching, whether it's a physical form of some sort or an idea, or a feeling that we can still label, you know, and related to when this is occurring in the brain here, and we have this. We can talk like this and get into very complicated descriptions, none of which are explaining anything. I've studied science to some degree, and one of the things I started to realize, it seemed like we were explaining a lot, so I started to realize science doesn't explain anything. A lot of scientists would agree with this, too, by the way. All it does is describe. We can describe what the appearances are, that it looks like this, it looks like that. And we can take these various things and break them down into their elemental constituents. And first we had the gross elements of earth, air, fire, water. Now we can break things down to, well, what shows up on the periodic table, you know, the various, you know, 62 or 92 elements and natural elements and then others as well. And, yeah. But, and then all the various things that we might want to play with here are made of those, at least in the physical world here, made of all of these various elements. So it isn't like this paper is, you know, some particular, but it's made of other things. And whatever it is we come to, it's made of it until we get all the way down to these elements. That's why they were called elements, because they got down to basically what we have here. But until we started to realize, well, no, these are made of these atoms. Yeah, but the atoms are made of electrons and protons and neutrons. And oh, okay, then when we get down a little closer, and we find out, well, the protons and neutrons are made of quarks, and, you know, and all these things are described, along with the electron, as point particles. I mean, they're just a single point in space, no dimensions. It's all made of that. And it, yes, but, well, okay, but we still have space, and we have time, you know, and that, all the stuff that we think about is either working in space or time, or we're conceptualizing it with space and time. Not everything, there's exceptions to this. But here's where science has gotten us right now. This is something that's occurred in the last 10 or 12 years, 15 years maybe at the most. This is something by Nima Arkani Hamid here, who is I think he might be a physicist, but he's a mathematician. And working with his teams, they have discovered, well, first they discovered what's called the amplitudehedron. You know what a hedron is, like the octahedron and icosahedron. This amplitudehedron, those other hedrons that occur in three-dimensional space, this doesn't. But what they've learned from this, well, this is what Arkani Hamid here says. He says, many, many separate arguments, all very strong individually, suggest that the very notion of space-time is not a fundamental one. We're not down to the fundamentals, the elements. It's not a fundamental one. Space-time is made of other things. Space-time is doomed, he says. There's no such thing as space-time fundamentally in the actual underlying description of the laws of physics. That's very startling. Because what physics is supposed to be about is describing things as they happen in space and time. So if there's no space-time, it's not clear what physics is about. And this is where we have statements from what I would call the awakened, these people who just see directly what's actually taking place here, who would not be startled by Arkani Hamid's statement there, that they can see already that whatever it is that you grasp, take hold of as an object, whether a physical object in the way that Arkani Hamid is talking about here, but even a thought or an idea, that is not, well, it can't be grasped. Nothing is being grasped there at all. There are people who have understood this just directly through realizing the nature of experience, direct experience, without forming it into something else. Over there, I mean that thing over here. Or this is what I mean when we're describing it, as science will do a description, philosophy as well. What is going on here? You cannot grasp it. I can't grasp it. Many of us think that we do grasp it and use it in all kinds of ways. But as for whether or not it's right or wrong or good or evil, and you're going to put everything on that, if you want to come to some true understanding of what's taking place here, you can't put anything into those forms and think that you're still dealing with reality. You can see this directly. Wang Po, Chinese Zen master from, well, it's over 1,000 years anyway, I think probably the 9th century, but he said, there's only the one mind, besides which nothing exists. He got this not because he understood what physicists like Arkani Hamid understands now today and where they are. He understood this from just directly realizing the actual experience of just this without putting it into language, into words, into forms, into arguments, anything of this sort. It's just seeing what it is and what is taking place here. And this is what the awakened see. But they don't see just this alone. They also see, but here we are. Can't say that this realization, direct realization of actual reality, is nothing just because you can't get hold of it. That only means you can't form it into an object in your mind. Well, you can, and we do, but then that's called delusion in Buddhism. If you believe that, this is delusion. And most of us live entirely out of delusion. Enlightenment, or this awakenedness, is nothing more than seeing delusion, realizing what delusion is. And it is just this. But as I was saying, but here we are. This isn't nothing. We can't just carry on as if, well, then there's, you know, what's the point of anything? We are here with people and animals and plants on a planet that provides us with air to breathe. All of this in a universe that seems vast. It actually isn't, given what Arkani Hamid has discovered. It's not vast. The awakened know this. It doesn't have any size. The universe is sizeless. I've lectured on this for years, actually. But it's hard to help people get to a point where I would say such an absurd thing as that. But this is what is here for us to see. And then within this, now, because we're not carrying a flag anymore, I'm not trying to convince you of anything here. I'm not giving you anything to believe. I don't have any beliefs about this. I don't even know what I'm saying exactly, other than trying to point something out. That's what the awakened do. They don't expect us to write down what they say and then believe it. It works like this. I'll give you an example. So you were looking at some kind of a moral system here. Morality doesn't work if we don't see clearly what is taking place here. It gets us into trouble. So how, apart from being amoral, or of course then there's immoral, but then there's morality there, but the negation of it. But say we take that finest of all moral rules, the golden rule. If you take this and apply it as if it's something you can apply, you're going to get into all kinds of troubles, and philosophers have for centuries. Get into trouble with the golden rule, because it says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. It sounds good. It's a pretty good idea. The general sense of it, yeah, go ahead and try that one. That's pretty good. If you can live by that, that's not too bad. But it will give you trouble. Maybe not you, but say you have some cantankerous fellow here who loves nothing better than getting into a good fight with somebody, So he goes around picking fights. He's doing unto others what he would have them do unto him. It doesn't work. The golden rule is flawed. But it's flawed because when we approach it with our conceptual minds, our intellectual grasps of various things, this and that, and try to apply it, is if reality were like that, it won't work. Sooner or later, you're going to run into contradictions. And you won't get out of these unless you wake up. Wake up to what? Well, wake up to what the conceptual is, what the conceptual world that we're constantly making is. And it contains these contradictions and flaws. But waking up to this is waking up to what our actual immediate direct perceptual experience is. I'm using the word perception now in a different way than you're used to, because most of the time we'll say things like, well, I perceive this microphone, and I perceive you sitting there in a chair, and you know, I perceive this building. We talk like that. I perceive maybe a thought that I have here, or the idea, oh, I see your idea now, I perceive that. But this isn't perception. There we might refer to it as conception. It is all conception, according to what the awakened see. We don't perceive objects. Our actual immediate direct perceptual experience is not of objects, and it's not with an eye and all of this. This is all belonging to the conceptual. And in the realm of the conceptual, that's where we can fight and argue and get into trouble, and we really believe this, and it counters what somebody else believes there, and next thing you know, you're going to start fighting. That's where all that is. What we can awaken to is that we don't have to live this way and with this kind of confusion. And with just a slight little adjustment to that golden rule, you can just see how it would work. It is simply, and this is how it's presented, when I was studying Buddhist thought, it's very much like the golden rule. In fact, it actually is the golden rule, but it's the negative. And it's just simply stating, do not do unto others what you would not have done unto you. This is not going to lead into snags and contradictions and trouble. And you can live on. Just look at our political scene today, where we have people who are so sure that they know the right thing to do, and they really want to push that through. And there's other people who are countering that with their good arguments. Not all, you know, some are good and some are terrible, but but some can be pretty good. And yet they all enter into this big, I don't know, turmoil. And people fight and die and kill each other over this. And it goes on and on and on and on and on. But if you look at what the awakened wake up to, what some people have awoken to, is that, but just making this one little thing, what is going on with the golden rule as we normally have it through in the conceptual form, it's kind of commanding you. Do unto others, kind of a command, do unto others what you would have done unto you. But maybe what I would want done unto me, through whatever quirks or craziness I might have, or just peculiarities of my personality or whatever, it might not be what others want or even what's good for them. It might not even be good what's good for me. But if it's just this little change where we're not recommending anything here at all, we're not offering any, the awakened way of taking the golden rule and just looking at it a little differently. It just simply says, do not do unto others what you would not have done unto you. It's not prescribing anything. It's not directing us to do anything in particular. It's kind of directing us to notice what you're doing and stop. Just see if you can stop. If you can't stop, well, just take a look at that. But notice that you're not stopping. And if you don't stop, well, then notice the entanglements that come with it, and the suffering, and the settledness of mind, or whatever it is that eudaimonia that you would like to seek and find in your life or present to the world here, is not going to be found in carrying on in just this way. It's rather than in seeing when we make these kinds of moves, not just bodily, physically, but also in our minds, and through our believing and through our philosophies, our religious dictums and whatever, keep creating this rats. I don't want to insult rats here, but this nest of confusion and difficulty. And as for identifying then what is good and what is bad, which we will do in the conceptual side of things, yeah, we can always identify what's good, what's bad, what's evil. That's easily done. But if we turn that around and we don't move in that direction, but just look at this and then don't step into things that are painful for you or for others. We just see this in a radically different way. And we don't drag ourselves into these kinds of conflicts. This is a subtle teaching that I'm offering you right here, and not easily understood. And in my case, it took many years of coming around to this in various ways and looking at it and examining it, you know, before I suddenly realized this is different from anything else you might want to pick up. This one, you can't even really pick it up, but you can see it. You can see how this works in the world and in your heart and your mind. And we can learn to live in this way, still interacting with others in the world, you know, taking care of the pains of the world in various ways, you know. But we can live free of fighting about what's good or bad. You know, there's a Taoist story of a wise Chinese farmer who his horse ran off one day. Maybe you know this story. I've heard it told more and more lately now. But often it's the point of it is missed. But the horse runs away and the neighbor comes to commiserate. Oh, that's too bad you lost your horse. And then the next day the horse comes back with more horses. Or the neighbor comes by and congratulates. Oh, I got all these horses. Oh, and it goes on and on. The farmer's son breaks his leg, you know, trying to tame one of the horses. And oh, that's too bad, you know. But oh, and at every turn the farmer just says, well, who can say what's good or bad? Who can say what's good or bad? He broke his leg. Oh, who can say what? Then the army came through conscripting men for some war that was going on, and they passed over his son because he had a broken leg. And oh, isn't that wonderful? They didn't take your son. And who can say what's good or bad? Said the farmer. I knew something like this. It does enter into Western thought too, because I remember as a kid, I knew Julie when we were children. I don't know if I learned this story then, but we were pretty young. But there's this joke that went kind of like this. I guess like you're in a plane, which is cool, that's nice. But all of a sudden you realize the plane's going to crash. Well, that's unfortunate. But then fortunately, you have a parachute. So you strap that on and jump free of the plane. But unfortunately, the parachute didn't open, you know. But fortunately, there was a haystack. Unfortunately, there was a pitchfork sticking up out of the haystack with the prongs up, you know. But fortunately, you missed the pitchfork, and unfortunately, you missed the haystack. I only gave that away. But anyway, I guess it splat at the end of that. But you see, that still has a kind of a grasping attitude, or we're bringing it to some kind of a conclusion here. The actual life that's being lived out here doesn't conclude in any way whatsoever. But there's a lot I could say about this in, you know, all kinds of aspects. It has to do with you and any number of things here, loved ones. But with the perceptual, there's no beginnings or ends. And so that's how it is in the story of the Chinese farmer. There's no ending in that story. This happens, oh, that's too bad. Oh, that led to the very next thing, which... how wonderful, that's great, you know, which leads to the next thing, which, oh, that's so bad, you know, and it goes on and on. There's no end to this story. And that's how we can see what's actually being lived out. It's of this nature. And if we can really take that into our heart and mind and understand that this is what's happening here, first of all, you aren't going to be going around and fighting with those who might have different political views, but you can take a different tact there and approach it in a radically different way and with a different heart, I would say. I'm not sure how long I've been speaking, but maybe I've said enough. So I'll stop here. But is there anything anybody would like to say, any questions? Or this is the kind of stuff I've studied, but the understanding is like this. You really understand this too. If you search your heart and your mind, you can see this. Because there's nothing here. I haven't given you anything to believe. If you think I have, tell me what it is. This is about just, for each of us, just watch your mind. And see how you're interacting with different things. And realize that your life doesn't end at your skin. It doesn't end at the reaches of your mind or whatever it might be. It is just, as Wang Po said, there's only this one mind. And this is what's being lived out. We experience it for each of us as me. Yeah, but what does me refer to? If you look carefully, and I've looked at this for decades, and you'll never find what that word is referring to, or the word I. And yet, here it is. And what does it refer to? It's just this. This is not nothing. When we peel away all the stuff, even now they're peeling away space and time. My gosh, what's left? You know, well, what's left is, here we are. It's just this. It is mind. The ancient Wang Po, they refer to it as mind very often. Using Romanized script, you can give that one a capital M, I would say, to distinguish it from something like your mind or my mind. Or ego mind or whatever. But this big mind, as it's sometimes called, I don't know, because it's sizeless too, so. But it's just the immediacy of just this. And of course, using language, and I just said the word this as if that means something. Here we have a question back here. But you'll never get hold of just what this is. It's just this. Yes.
Is the Eightfold Path then a tool to see the mind?
Oh, I wouldn't say that. No, though if you follow the Eightfold Path, it'll help. You do see the mind. All we ever see is mind. I mean, as Wang Po puts it, that's all there is. You know, but it's not a thing, and it won't be a conceptual seeing, or even an intellectual understanding. I have no idea what that. I don't have any ideas about that. I don't have any ideas about me. I don't have any ideas about the election coming. I'm very much concerned with all of that, and I'm paying attention, and I will act, and you know. But that's different than driving ourselves over the edge with everything and fighting with people. How helpful is that? So this is just a radically different way of living from how we might otherwise live when we have a grasping mind. We're allowing our grasping. I grasp too, but I keep watching for that I don't go too far with this. Because it's impossible, it's almost impossible to really be without that. I don't know if that is possible. But we can start to see what's causing the pain and the confusion in our lives and realize that we don't have to step into it all the time. Yeah, we have a question here.
So, I read your book, Buddhism Plain and Simple, and I really, really enjoyed it. And I've been thinking actually a lot about what you said about the golden rule, and if I'm citing it correctly, do not do unto others as you would not do unto yourself. Mm-hmm. And that really resonates with me. It's something that I feel like that makes a lot of sense to me. The place that I wonder about, so I've in my life, I work as a social worker or a clinical social worker, and there are times that I see others doing onto others that I would not have done onto myself, or that they are doing onto themselves things that I would not do unto myself. Mm-hmm. And there's a piece that I can sit back. I guess the place that I'm struggling with is there's a part of me that I can sit back in a witnessing self and try to notice my thoughts and my thought, maybe some of my thought distortions, mm-hmm. and the conclusions I might jump to. But there's also a part of me that in the life that I live, where I do go to work and I do want to be a part of this world, how do I respond to when I see others doing unto others as I wouldn't have done unto myself, or do I just witness it and just...
Well, you can do a lot more than that, but...
I try to.
Yeah, but when we get into that outward action, that's very difficult. You have to be... I have to be very careful there, but it's just work with your own mind at first. And what you can do there is, thank you for bringing it up, because there was another point I did want to talk about tonight that I forgot about, but now it reminds me of another thing as well, but that relates to this. But, and it's in Buddhism, Plain and Simple, where I talk about this, and I don't think people realize how profound it is or how powerful it is, because with the awakening and waking up to this, it's like waking up to totality. I say like, because you can't exactly wake up to totality. But it is like that. I'm going to talk about something related to this tomorrow morning when I'm meeting with the Zen group there. It'll be from the Xinjing Ming, but it relates to this. But totality isn't a thing or an object. It is that one mind, we could say, but it's like everything, except it isn't anything unto itself, but it's clearly not nothing as well. Okay, you can make your mind just like that. And this is how you do it. And then when you're faced with that situation, say if somebody is beating on someone else or whatever the story might be there, what can you do? And certainly there are moments when maybe you can and you have to and you should step in and do something. But this is where you want to have your mind. And it is simply watching your mind. I that's a phrase I use in that book fairly frequently.
Yeah.
Watch your mind. And what I'm referring to there then is, I don't mean and straighten your mind out and do something about it. What you want to watch, see if your mind is leaning toward some solution, some action, or this action or over here or something like this. Or you're going to intend to do this or you intend to do that. That's what you want to watch for. And see if you can refrain from acting out of intention. Because ego is now involved and it's one-on-one, or it's like one thing in conflict against another and this sort of thing. That relates to this other thing, but I don't know if I could, I don't want to take too much time here now, but it's another little story, but it's a great one. I was a young American young man who was traveling in, I don't know, say Japan, I think, probably, say, taking the train or whatever it was. And it stopped at various stops, and people would get on or get off. And at this one stop, this drunken man got on. He's all disheveled, and he's hair's matted, and he's dirty, and he smells of alcohol, and he's very belligerent and being nasty to people. And, well, this young man had been studying what, Aikido or one of the martial arts, I don't know what, but and he thought, well, I'm going to take this guy out. And so he starts to get up, I guess. Then the belligerent man says, yeah, what are you, you know, and he's going to go after that young man. When all of a sudden there's this ear-shattering kind of a call, like, hey, you know, and right next to this big, dirty, disheveled man was this little old man just sitting there in the seat, and he called out, hey, you know, something, you know, just get the guy's attention. And the old, the disheveled fellow, he says, what do you want, old man, or, you know, and I forget exactly how it goes, but very quickly, the old man, pretty soon he's talking about, you know, his wife and how they have a garden, and you know, and he's talking about things like this, and the nasty man, see, I'm using the wrong word now already, but the belligerent man, he starts to calm down a bit, and then as the old man is talking about, he and his wife would work in the garden and stuff, he starts crying. He says, "I ain't got no wife," he says, "and I ain't got no job." And he starts describing what's going on with him. It's like his whole life is falling apart. And after a little bit, pretty soon, he's crying on the old man's shoulder. And on that bus or train or whatever it was, where everybody a few minutes earlier just wanted to kill this guy and get, you know, and look at our political system. How many people want to kill him? And within a few minutes, all of a sudden, everybody on that bus, they were feeling for the disheveled guy. And so, but that old man took, here this young man, he was going to take him out. It was the young man who told the story about this. Yeah. So, because he learned a lesson there. It wasn't just his martial arts he needed to learn. There's something else, too. And that old man demonstrated it there. Where he just kind of forgot himself. He reaches towards it and shows a little kindness. And it might not always work, perhaps, but if it's coming from a genuine heart and mind, you know, and you're not holding your own in that way, you know, your mind isn't leaning toward, you know, oh, I got to do this or I have to make it work. Just open to the whole. And he could act out of that. So if you want your mind to stay in this place of wholeness, watch for these leanings that are occurring. I got to do that. And just see if you can learn to back away from those. And it might take some time, but more and more we can learn to do that.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Did I see another hand? Yeah.
This may not require an answer, as you may have already covered it in your last response. But I'm thinking in the current political climate, and thinking of your story about the farmer and wasn't this good, and, you know, mm-hmm. back and forth.
Are you saying who can say if right. what's
and
good
I'm,
or bad?
I'm thinking about that, but I'm thinking about also, you know, how to act. And does that back and forth kind of make you think it's futile to act? You know, that's the first thought in mind. Is it futile to act? But not for me. Not for me. The next step is to think about, well, I don't want to speak ill of one side or the other, but I want to act. I have an inclination, and I want to act upon that, but in a way, and what would the Dharma say?
I don't know, the Dharma. I can tell you what my teacher would say about that very specific sort of thing. He said what he's learned to do, it's like the major thing that he learned in his life, is to how to keep his hands off. And he said, in most situations, there's probably nothing you can do directly. But if your mind isn't being tossed away by it in one way or another, or leaning, and we got to put this guy out or whatever, if it's really just right there, you're in the best position to see if there is something you can do. Like that old man, and he just quickly responded and saved the day for everybody on the bus. And that's what you, so it's not a matter of should I act or not act. That's not the first question. And when it's time for the action, we can just act without really thinking. But everything's been opened and you can really see. It isn't like you're just acting blindly now. It's a very clear seeing of what needs to be done. But that's what has to happen. You have to first realize what needs to be done. And that might not be there with us when we're grasping at various things. But this is something we can kind of cultivate and learn and practice over time, gradually. You know, we can get a little better at it. I don't know anybody who's perfected living this way. I haven't. I've been at it a long time. But we can learn as we go. But it's this first thing is to not act. Do not do unto others. Whatever, even if it's my good idea, I'm going to do something nice for you. Well, who can say what's good or bad? There's that element's being overlooked. So gradually we can take all of this in and start to live out of it. It starts to become what we're living with. So we can react or not react. And like my teacher said, what he learned finally is how not to act. You know, but, you know, how to keep his hands off of things. Rather than getting in there, wanting the help, and then making it worse. I've known people, actually, I can think of two instances where they really wanted to help save somebody's life. And actually, in both cases, their actions actually killed the person. And how that was devastating, not just for them, but to the victim, who knows, but to their family and the families and the anguish that they felt and all of that. But who are you going to blame now? These people acted, they wanted to do the right thing. They made a mistake, and it was like the wrong thing. But then there's nothing to blame there. If these people were clearly full of remorse, you know, can you imagine too? I don't know if I can just try to imagine myself. If I had done something, like I'm trying to help somebody, and I end up killing them, which was the opposite of what I was trying to do, that would be hard to live with, you know. But so that's another kind of pain that we can create as well. But it's also difficult if there's a situation where maybe you can't even act in this point. At this point, very hard to not do something. But that might be the move. And also, another thing we don't know is that by not doing something in this moment here, this instant, suddenly a new thing opens up, and now we do know how to act. So those possibilities are there too. You can't predict these or try to calculate them out or whatever. It's a matter of just keeping your mind very present. Somebody asked the Buddha to sum up his teaching in a single word. He said awareness. And he's talking about this kind of awareness, not awareness of objects or things or thoughts and calculations and stuff like this. Just aware of this, just being open to what is actually being lived out. And then we can respond in a very natural way. It'll feel kind of natural as opposed to, oh, I did that. I don't know if that was the right thing to do. So, but again, there's no perfection here. This is just pointing out there's other ways of living than out of our normal ways of immediately, I got to do something about this. Maybe so, but wait another minute. It might become obvious what it is. That sort of thing. So I'm not even really recommending, but it's just a matter of, this is what I learned from my teacher, one of many things, but to be watching for this in my own mind, and then the actions that might come from what I'm doing. And sometimes it's helpful, and I can respond properly. And there's times even now, I mean, I've been attempting this over 50 years, and I haven't perfected it, and I can still make mistakes. But also then I can learn to forgive myself, sort of. Not excuse myself, but I can learn to maybe not beat up on myself, so I can stay ready to maybe respond in the next moment, if it's so called. And I'm also not talking about being so watchful that, oh, just like you're focused on everything. We can't do that. Just stay with where you know where you're looking. Where you and something happens right here, and you missed it because you were just, yeah. We don't have 360. You know, in tuned with everything, sight and sound and everything else. You know, so just become kind of realistic in that way. But it's just a matter of loosening your heart and mind and being present and watching the jabbering going on in your mind. You know, there might be a time and place for that at your work or wherever else. You know, you need to be thinking and whatever it might be, strategizing and that, yeah. There's a place for that, and there's also a place where maybe it's not so necessary. You know, but we can learn these things, but we only learn these things by observing our minds and not judging ourselves in the process.
Can you say something more about this concept of one mind?
It's actually not a concept, because I have no conception of what one mind is. What is it? Okay, it is just this. That's what Wang Po is referring to, huh?
It sounds like one God or one.
One God, yeah. Like, it could sound that way, but that's not it. God is an object. God is a thing. God is something formed. God is an idea. God is a concept. People have all kinds of ideas about gods. God's like this, or God's like that, or no, but this God is better than that and bigger than that. And then we're fighting. Now we're lost in confusion and fantasy and imagination. Much of this we, over the centuries with human beings, we've taken for solid reality that we fight over and carry on, have wars and really abuse people in all sorts of ways. Yeah, so like we just continuously live out of insanity instead of realizing that, you know, we can slow down, we can stop, we can pay attention. And with this, quite naturally, there'll be a loving heart, like the old man on the bus, just open to this. And I'm sure that he had genuine feelings of pain for the man that came on, who had lost his job, whatever, his wife, who knows what, was falling apart in his life. Just having some real feeling for him, you know. And maybe not doing much more than letting him cry on his shoulder. So, but as to, you know, what is it? Can't say. Buddhism, too, Buddha Dharma is not a belief system. It's not about believing something. And I'm not really giving you anything here to believe in. It's just a matter of just notice how we live moment to moment. This is of vital importance in this kind of teaching and in this practice. And I know a lot of people who have studied and practiced Buddhism for many years and who still don't quite realize it and are still trying to push one thing through or another. And I went to Japan, I studied there, and I acquired all the robes, I got transmission, the whole thing. So I could have really come in here decked out with a lot of my stuff and whisks and things, and it would look pretty fancy, but it wouldn't help you. In fact, it would harm you. It would get you lost in the confusion. So when I came back from Japan, I gave away just about all my stuff to one of my Dharma brothers who does use this stuff. I don't condemn him for doing that. I told him why I don't and why I didn't have it at our center there. No, but those things will change, and that's fine. I'm not for it. I'm not against it. But there are ways of capturing people for all the wrong reasons, and I don't want to capture anybody, you know? So we could just, like my teacher said, just learn to keep our hands off. Stop trying to do too much. All I want to do is to help people wake up. Notice what's going on. Notice what you're doing. Watch your mind. I'm not going to tell you what to think or do. Just suggesting that just take a look at what you are doing. And don't beat yourself up when you start to notice maybe you're doing some things that aren't particularly healthy or helpful. And that's a big lesson, too. Yeah. But I guess I wandered far from your question. but as to what this is, yeah, see, I can't say, because that's putting something there now. And then believe this? But I don't want to do that. I don't want to put anything there. I don't want to come in with all the different instruments and things that I acquired when I was studying in Japan and my colorful robes and things. This is enough. I'm wearing this. This means I've had, that color means I've had Dharma transmission. Okay, that's all it means. I told you now, but I didn't, you know.
So I'm just a little curious, and maybe this is my own dense mind not able to grasp, or why did you bring up that comment that there's one mind? It's like, it doesn't seem to relate to the other things that you're asking us to consider about.
Well, it stands in stark contrast with everything I was saying, and that is, it's sort of like this. One of the teachings, this is a very profound teaching and usually takes people some time. It took me some years to understand, to wake up to what it was actually pointing out. It's called the Two Truths. So most of what I was talking about, it belongs to this realm of what we call relative truth or small t truth or something like that, as opposed to this other truth, which is truth absolute or maybe something others than just absolute. But there's nothing to say about that. That's truth with a capital T. If I happen to mention it or write it in a book or something, then I'll use a capital T for that to designate that this is not like the truth that there's a chair over here on the floor here or there's a microphone in front of me. That's relatively true. But if, as Nima Arkani Hamid says, well, we don't have space and time, so how true is it that there's a microphone in front of me? Or just even in front of, or there, as opposed to here? So how true are these things? And this is what I was saying in my remarks, is that in that world of small t truth, where all our conceptual stuff, that's where all our pain and suffering is, all, where all our confusion is. There's no substance behind it. These are appearances of mind, and this is that one mind. And it's only the one mind. It looks like all of this, it sounds like all, it tastes like, feels like, you know, the thoughts and impressions, and the pains of, and all of this, and the joys of. And it's all wonderful. It's not about destroying it or saying it's bad or doing something about it. It's getting to know it, realize what this is. And that is this one mind. It is all of this one mind. It isn't of the many as it appears to be, and we can live with all the joys and sorrows of the appears to be, but we can also live in a way where we understand what's happening, we understand what's going on. And the nature of reality is actually mind. It's not the physical, and we think the mind is created by the brain and all that. Those ideas are falling apart now at long last. And that's not in the popular world yet of scientific study, but that's where things are headed, especially with somebody like Nima or Khani Hamid coming along. And there's others like him. This is kind of the new front of the frontiers of science and neuroscience and all this kind of stuff. But mind is not, people think, can we, with AI, can we generate a conscious machine? No, we cannot. The scientist, Federico Fajin, he's the guy, whenever you use your touchscreen phone or iPod or whatever it might be, the touchscreen stuff, you know, and you can click and think, the guy who invented that, he had set out some years ago to invent a conscious computer. And within a few years, he realized the consciousness is of a different order altogether. We don't make consciousness. We can't generate consciousness. Consciousness generates us, except it isn't consciousness. The consciousness is an aspect of this one mind. That is the generation of this and that. I mean, it is that. It's the touching and the seeing. This is all actually, at some point, really becomes obvious. And it's not the other way around, that we take these different things now, these different elements, and we put them together, and we can create something called consciousness. Well, consciousness is elemental, not the stuff. Even now, space and time aren't even elemental. But science is coming to this now, on the very frontiers of it. Most scientists yet probably don't know about this. I happen to know about it because I study this. I don't know why I study it. I'm fascinated by it. And I shouldn't be talking about it here now because it's maybe too far out. Yeah, there's another question? Yes.
So one thing you just said a little bit ago, and it's something I've learned, is, you know, when you realize, you know, you do the practice, but you realize you're a human being, and you do screw up, and you do things, and you're like, why did I do that? And you said don't beat yourself up, but a little bit earlier you said, I can't remember how you said it, I don't excuse myself, but I forgive myself, but I don't excuse myself. Mm-hmm. That kind of hit me as like, there's kind of a narrow line in there, because like, if you just excuse yourself, you're going to keep doing the same thing, right? But if you forgive yourself, you're being easy on, you're being a lot lighter on yourself, and it's, you kind of learn more of a lesson of how you don't want to be. But I just, can you just explain that a little bit more?
Well, how helpful is it to, say, beat the child when the child misbehaves, or kick the dog when whatever? I mean, you know, and why beat yourself up? If in this moment now you realize this wasn't good, this brought some pain into the world here, this, you know, for whatever reason. And yes, I was angry, I just, you know, okay, but we're human, and this will happen. How big was it? If it's something that maybe you got to go to the authorities about, okay, then there it is. See if you can take care of that. That might be a hard thing to do, but it's like that. So don't excuse it. But at the same time, you are human. And you might start to realize about yourself that you have a fiery temper. I kind of realized that about myself as a young person. I used to flare up. I never took it out on anybody. I'd punch the wall. I wouldn't punch a person, but I had a pretty quick temper. I still do. My partner Ann here, she might think I still do. I don't know. But it doesn't go very far at all. But I haven't perfected that yet. And I don't know if I will. And that's not the point. But if I didn't accept that and realize it, you know, if I just excused it, like, oh well, that's just how I am. No, I see it. And whenever I lose it like that, I don't do it so often anymore, like it once was. But there's still work to be done. But that work couldn't be done if we don't admit to this. You know, we don't, you know, take care of it. But here it is. Yes, I did this. But don't beat yourself up. You keep ignoring it and that sort of thing. Yeah, I guess you won't beat yourself up over that either. But that isn't helping anything.
So essentially, when you forgive yourself, you're acknowledging it. And you're bringing it to your own attention. But excusing it, you're just kind of like, bleh.
Yeah. It's like, well, I can't help it. That's just how I am. Yeah, that sort of thing. And not taking responsibility. But the fact that, yeah, okay, I flew off the handle again, because maybe, you know, but we can start to learn to maybe not do it as frequently or as with as much intensity. You know, it isn't like all of a sudden, no, I just don't do that anymore. I used to do that. But that can change over time, you know. I did go through a period where very quickly I changed in a lot of different ways, but there's still some of these things that go on. But I wouldn't call myself an angry guy anymore. I don't know if I was ever really angry much, but I could be set off. Okay, is that it? Are we done?
Oh, Gary?
Following up on the question of one mind, is there, in your mind, is there a difference between one mind and a non-dual mind?
Well, I really don't understand either term, but non-dual mind, I have no idea what that is. I really don't have any idea what one mind is either, except, but it's not an idea, but just this. You see, this isn't nothing. That's obvious. And that's all. That's all I can say. It's obvious. Here it is. What is it? It's like, is that a question, really?
So by saying it's this, or it is.
I don't think it's this. I don't think anything in regards to that. But there is this without me thinking or not thinking about it, or using labels or saying a word or anything. There's this.
I mean, it's how to approach without concepts.
You can't approach without concepts.
But if you use concepts, you're missing.
Well, approaching itself is already a concept. You can't approach without you can't do anything without concepts. In terms of interacting with the relative world, which we have to, because here we are, we have bodies, we know people, we can create pain in the world, we can also heal pain, and there's a lot of things we can do here, so we can't ignore this. But we don't have to carry on as if this stuff was ultimately substantial in and of itself, because you'll never arrive at that substantiality. But what you will arrive at finally is realizing the true nature of what's appearing here.
And how does consciousness overlay mind, or how mind overlays consciousness?
They don't. It's almost as if they're one and the same thing. We could say that consciousness is what mind does, but that reminds me of that thing about that the brain is what the mind, or the mind is what the brain does. I don't want to go there. I'm certainly not going there, but even to say consciousness is what the mind does. Whatever we say now is wrong. And so I really don't want to talk here in this area, because everything that we say becomes conceptualized, and when we're talking about the one mind, we're talking about...
So
we're talking about direct experience and not a conceptualized version of it.
So language is an impediment to understanding consciousness and mind.
Well, it could be, yes. Because you can't put it in language.
And that's why you're framing it as it is. Because it seems to make it ambiguous without borders. The word is.
Well, see what you're trying to do here. You're reaching into this realm. I talked about those two truths, which, by the way, are not two. But we can talk about them that way. But the relative world of this and that, birth and death and all of this stuff. And then there's, we could say, truth absolute. Some people call it that. I don't find that helpful, using the word absolute at that point. But maybe ultimate truth or something. But words don't apply. Even the word truth doesn't apply, let alone adding a descriptor to that word. And there's really nothing to say there. But you're asking me to speak now there. And what I'm saying is that everything I say now is really over here with this relative truth. And it isn't really helping you to realize the absolute truth. The other thing is, I don't have to help you realize absolute truth because you already do. You just don't recognize that you do.
And
all we experience is absolute truth.
And that's what awakeness is.
Awakeness is finally realizing what's going on. Yeah.
Without
and
concepts,
there's like nothing
language.
To say. Huh?
Without concepts, without language.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We certainly can.
So you have awakeness, you have consciousness, you have mind.
When you're saying you, are you talking about me?
The one has.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't even say one in that way. There's only the one. I would capitalize that one, the one mind.
So awareness.
But it's one without another. But that's not me, it's not you.
Awareness.
It's not that chair.
It's that awareness and consciousness and mind meld.
No, you're starting out with the particle or the particulate, the relative, the this and that, the conceptual, and you're going toward that, and then saying, do they meld into? No, you're going backwards. If anything, they come out of that, but that's not even really quite right either. Nothing comes out of it. I gave a talk that was sort of a lead up to this particular discussion, that's on our website now at Dharmafields. I talked couple Sundays ago, and it's called Nothing is Impermanent, and kind of showing the idea that we have that an early teaching in Buddhism is that, well, everything is impermanent. No matter what we have here, it's impermanent. It won't last. Well, even the earth, it won't last. You know? Well, we get into the subtleties of impermanence, and we begin to realize, as Nagarjuna in the second century pointed out, that actually the real understanding of impermanence is that nothing is impermanent. So I give a talk on that, and that would help with what we're discussing now. And you can listen to it. It's on our Dharmafield website. Just go there and just Dharmafield, small d, it's all lowercase, dharmafield.org. Just go there and then, well, that's probably a YouTube talk, so there's a YouTube. Just click on it, and you get the menu there or whatever. You can click on it, and you can listen to it. It's also in an audio form, too, on our website. But that will say everything that you're... I think at the end of that talk I gave, it'll take care of your question.
Very good. Thank you.
Yeah.
Against my better judgment, I'm going to open my mouth and say something. But are you essentially saying that the situation of impermanence, constant change, is in fact, it's permanent.
No.
It's always permanently impermanent.
Yeah, well, it isn't anything, because nothing is impermanent. But what it really means, well, the way to look at it that might help it make some sense, is that the impermanence is occurring so rapidly and continuously that there's nothing formed in the first place to be impermanent. And the things that appear to be formed and then persist or exist in time and space, which now scientists are beginning to realize don't exist, but they are appearances, and the ancients have realized that for a long time. But anyway, but the things that are appearing here then, well, that's just it, they're appearances, and they appear, the changes that are occurring there are so rapid that there's actually nothing formed. But now, with this, now we have things like movement and the appearance of change. With that, the appearance of time. And of course, there's dimensionality here too. There's space, so there's a there and a here, and you know, stuff like this. And all of this then now is occurring because it is, there's absolutely no permanence anywhere. Not in thoughts or feelings or ideas or objects or physicality or even now space and time. They're beginning to realize that these aren't made of lasting things. They're continuously being replaced by the next one.
Well, on a quantum level, everything's winking in and out of existence constantly.
Yeah. This is even what Arkani Hamid was talking about, is even going way below that. There's like nothing, except it isn't nothing. It isn't nothing. Did I say that clearly? What's the proof of that? Well, just look. This isn't nothing. It's obvious. But then we think it's something. Because if it isn't nothing, then it must be something. No. And see, by understanding that perceptual truth, the capital T truth there, you'd realize that actually we don't actually have something. Or we would realize this thoroughgoing impermanence. So we can't really say that there's something. But then you mean there's nothing. Well, see, our conceptualizing mind will leap between these two extremes. Well, either there's something or there's nothing. No, that's not the case. Were that the case, nothing would be happening. Everything would be frozen. And so in order to have this dynamic universe that we appear to have, it is because there isn't anything lasting here. There isn't any. And then we look at the fact that nothing lasts as sort of a very sad thing. You know, people die, loved ones die, all of this, which is true. We can feel that. And it can be very sad and painful. But all of this is through this wonderful, exuberant, just turning over of everything in each moment where nothing at all of any sort, physical or mental or emotional or anything else, is lasting. Even for a moment. And that's the nature of this reality, is of that nature. And if we actually see that, then big questions and fears of not just our loved ones, but even me, ooh, I'm going to die. You know, I was just diagnosed with two major cancers in the last year that I've been treated for. I just finished 6 weeks of immunotherapy a couple days ago. I'm still here. The first one I had, I've had four major cancers in my life. First one when I was 32, they weren't expecting me to live more than a couple of months, but I'm still here. I'm not 32, I'm not 30, I'm 78. And but then last year, I had prostate cancer, and that had to be treated, and it was. That was 12 years ago. Then last summer, I had lung cancer. I don't smoke, but I had lung cancer, the most common form of lung cancer among non-smokers. I got it. And I've had bladder cancer. Okay. So I'm thinking, all right, and I'm 78. Well, how much longer am I going to go on? And this could be a worrisome thing. Could be. I think at one time it would have been for me. It isn't now. Because I really can't even imagine what I am in the first place as a formed thing. My life has changed in so many ways over the course of these 78 years, but even moment by moment. This time last year, I didn't know I was going to be diagnosed with two different forms of cancer in the next year, after I've already had a couple of big ones. So you never know. I might not make it back to our apartment tonight. But that's the case for all of us. I'm certainly not special in this way. But if you see yourself as a permanent thing that's persisting through time and was born at some point and it's persisting now and then it's going to end Don't know, quite know when. I hope it'll go a while yet, but don't know. And then that's a very worrisome thing for people. But it doesn't have to be that way. Because you can see that that's all based on ideas that actually are self-contradictory and paradoxical and wrong. And if you actually see that, there's a big burden lifted off of you right there. I'm not talking about believing or visualizing. So you mean you're going to go on? No, I have no idea that, I don't even know what I refers to. I don't know what goes on. But I know we actually don't have things going. We don't have, it looks like we have things coming and going. That's what the whole relative world is. It's nothing but those appearances. But that's not the whole thing. And with the whole thing, all of the stuff that we could get so hot and bothered about, get in our political party and fight to the death over this and that, one thing, piece of nonsense over another. Well, a lot of nonsense seems to be heavily weighted on one side there, but I don't want to get political. But we'll take all this stuff very seriously. We need to take it seriously. I take it seriously too, but I don't take it as being that it's going to smack me and crush me, because the world doesn't live that way. We do, because we keep trying to tell stories about or spinning out a storyline about myself or about where it needs to go and that sort of, but we don't have to live that way. But we can live in accordance with what's actually coming up. So I'm not talking about closing your eyes or ignoring it or plugging your ears or, you know, that whole thing about the monkeys with the see no evil and hear no evil and the speak no evil, that's been misinterpreted. That is a Buddhist idea originally. But it doesn't mean, oh, I don't want to hear bad words. I don't want to see that. I won't speak. That's not what it means. The actual meaning of that is that with a true seeing of what's taking place there, nothing to say. There's nothing coming in through the ears that you need to repackage or formulate or figure out, and nothing to see in terms of substantiality and this sort of thing. That's what it means. But it doesn't mean this is nothing or that there's no seeing or, we even have like in the Heart Sutra where it says no seeing, no eyes, no ears, no seeing, no hearing, etc. It doesn't mean what it, on the surface, it appears to mean. The knowledge and experience of the world is immediate and direct, and it doesn't come to us through our senses. It appears to. Sounds like it, feels like it, tastes like it, but and if it's true that we don't have space and time now, well, how are you going to sustain those things or pretty much anything else? But here it is, but it's impermanent. The impermanence is so thorough, can't get hold of anything here. Okay.
How does this resonate with you? If you know how to live, you know how to die. You know how to die, you know how to live.
Yeah.
How does that resonate with you?
Yeah, we can, up on that level, whereas you and you know how to do this and you know how to do that. Yeah, I can see that, but the real understanding of it is a little bit more subtle than that. And, that there isn't, some of the things I was just saying here, implicit in that is that, well, there isn't a me formed in the first place, that's subject to this, that's persisting now. So I don't see death. Is there death? Yeah. Is Steve Hagen going to die? Yeah, I think so. I'm pretty acquainted with death. As Julie knows, I lost my father suddenly when I was 6 years old. So I've been pretty familiar with this, and even from the time I was a little boy, I used to just think about death, and because it had such an impact on my life. But I've had now 72 years to think about it. Well, long before now, I finally realized what's going on here. So, and it's not troubling. But when we still see ourselves as, and that's a pretty persistent and pretty powerful illusion. Yeah, and I'm going to die. Yeah. And our loved ones will die. Yeah, there's some powerful stuff there. But if we really see what's going on, Things aren't really unfolding the way they appear to be. And I'm not talking about going to some afterlife or nothing here to believe. But the way we normally see it, though, is put together in kind of a delusional way. It's very illusory, but we don't see the illusion. And so we still buy that and we see it that way. But if you realize that it can't be that way, and that's kind of how I discovered it finally, was that it can't be the way it appears to be. And a little unsettled, then how is it? And then I realized this is its dynamic reality, is that you can't say how it is. It isn't any particular way, it's impermanent, which means it's full of dynamic change. But there's no particular thing there that's coming or going. It looks like it, being born and dying and all of this, persisting for a time, a lifetime. So that's how it looks. But that's not exactly, you can't defend that. I can, in all sorts of ways, I could take that apart for you. That it kept, I can show you there's all kinds of contradictions in that way of viewing the world. I can't give you anything in place of it, but at some point you can realize you don't need to have something in place of it. All we need to do is to finally understand this. Was there a question or no? Well, just this.
So on an ultimate level, there's no me.
Well, you can't really say there's no me, because there looks like, as far as you're concerned, it seems like there's a me. Same for me.
It's on a relative level.
I don't say there's no me.
On a relative level.
But it's just that me doesn't really refer to anything, and that's, but there's a sense of, I still have a sense of me. Sometimes it's not, doesn't seem to be around, but it still comes back, and I watch it, because I don't want it to get too strong, because the next thing I know, I'll start getting angry or something. But we can learn to see this.
Can you just do one more question?
One more question? Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
Just this. And I've seen others say and do this and do some expression, expressing things, and then say just this.
Yeah.
And hold their hands out. And just now you said just this, and you kind of wrote, like, throwing it out to us.
Yeah, well.
And
yeah.
So.
Well, here it is.
So,
Yeah.
So, and you look like you're kind of holding something. You go like this, like you're presenting this.
Yeah,
Are you kind of presenting everything or nothing?
Well, I'm not presenting anything, but I'm.
I mean, it's.
Yeah, I'm like, just trying to point out, just give you some sense of what to look for. And actually what to look for in your own thoughts that actually don't hold up. And if you can allow those, if you start to see the contradictions and let them fall away, at some point the whole thing really kind of pops into view. So that's all. But I'm not going to hand you something, because even what pops into view isn't something. But here it is. But it's just a radically different way. At this point, it's almost worthless to say much of anything else. Because in the end, we can't. And the reason we can't describe reality is because all we can do is put it into a conceptual form. And whatever that form is not. Reality is that, but that's not reality. That's another saying that we have. You can think about that for a while. Some of these things you might have to think about. I wouldn't think too hard, though. But it's informing us to notice the way that we do think. And we can start to see there's contradictions in the way we normally think. And it's a real release, a real freedom when we see through this.
All right.
Thank
you.
Okay, thank you.